What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is a Cactus 1549. Hit birds. We've lost thrust on both engines. We are turning back towards the LaGuardia.
Which engine did you lose?
Both engines.
And we sit here and talk about movies.
Josh, I just spilled Diet Mountain Dew on the mixing board. Both mics are down.
Tom Hanks is never going to play us in the movie, Adam.
No.
Hanks there as Chesley Sully Sullenberger in that clip from Clint Eastwood's Sully. It opened last weekend. We've got a review and much more ahead on Film Spotting.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh. I'm Adam. The mixing board has been wiped up. It's good. It took a little while to clean up, but we are ready to move ahead. And we did have a little bit of a change of plans. Everyone is wondering, where's the Oliver Stone extravaganza you guys have been promising for 2 weeks? We want our Matt Zoller sights. We want our top five Oliver Stone moments. Maybe a little talk about his new movie Snowden, which opens this weekend and which I have seen. And, of course, a Sacred Cow review of Born on the 4th of July. We will get to them. We did have to push that show back a week. More time to prepare. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, I don't feel too badly because now I can squeeze in a few of the Stone films that I haven't seen. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to prioritize Heaven and Earth and also hopefully finish Matt's book, which I'm about halfway through at this point.
That's incredible.
Really enjoying. So I can get to that in the next week. We'll be all set for the show.
I have started the book. Alas, I don't know that I'll finish it. And I've caught
it's
up with
big. It's
a
big.
Couple of his films, Oliver Stone's films, that is, not Matt's. But Heaven and Earth is one that's still sitting out there calling to me. We'll see if I do make time for that. That show will come next week.
First, though, Clint Eastwood directing Tom Hanks in a dramatization of the successful emergency landing of a commercial airplane on the Hudson River in 2009. All seems pretty straightforward, but is Sully up to something more?
No one warned us. No one said you were going to lose both engines at a lower altitude than any jet in history. This was dual engine loss at 2,800 feet, followed by an immediate water landing with 155 souls on board. No one has ever trained for an incident like that.
Our job is to investigate how a plane ended up in the Hudson River.
On the Hudson.
It's not a crash. It was a forced water landing.
Simulation showed that you could make it back to the airport.
Not possible. I felt it go. My aircraft.
Your aircraft.
I want you to know I did the best I could.
Of course you did. You saved everyone.
People call you a hero.
I don't feel like a hero.
Show us your case, Super Sally.
I don't recall anybody getting too excited or being too surprised when it was announced that Clint Eastwood was directing a movie about the 2009 U.S. Airways flight that had to make an emergency landing on the Hudson River after bird strikes caused both engines to fail. Well, beyond the surprise of most of us wondering where the drama would be in a movie about an emergency landing, we all knew was successful. The man who safely landed the craft, Captain Chesley Sullenberger, was reluctantly proclaimed a national hero, and Eastwood certainly isn't new to reluctant heroes. We could probably spend 5 minutes listing off some of his protagonists, Josh, Chris Kyle recently in American Sniper, William Money, of course, in Unforgiven, the soldiers who raised the flag at Iwo Jima in The Flags of Our Fathers. Eastwood also isn't new to stories venerating professionalism, integrity, and experience. Just like the character Tom Hanks portrays in Sully, Eastwood has been at this directing game for over 40 years. Stories of his directing style match Hanks's portrayal of Sully. He's calm, in control. He's efficient, no wasted setups, no unnecessary takes. There isn't even any delineation, really, between when you're on and when you're not. He doesn't say cut. He doesn't say action. When you're on set, you're basically working. Josh, the portrait of the miracle on the Hudson that emerges in this movie is the perfect marriage of man and machine. Is Sully the perfect marriage of man and material?
Maybe too perfect. I mean, it does feel like something maybe Eastwood could direct in his sleep. And sometimes his movies feel that way to me. I think you can sense that sort of, yes, there's control, but there's also maybe Woody Allen's films sometimes feel the same way. Not autopilot. That's too extreme. But they're not going to surprise you in mm-hmm. a way. And I think the particular problem with Sully operating in that manner is that this story really needs a surprise. It needs something. For the reason you mentioned, we know everything comes out okay, but also because the trailer seemed to tease that in suggesting, which we've both said we didn't know at the time, we didn't remember hearing about this, that the investigation of this landing was a little more contentious. The suggestion, and this comes out very early on in the film, it's really the thrust of the film, this investigation, that Sully could possibly have landed the plane at a nearby field, thereby not risking all of the passengers' lives. And so that's the twist, if there's going to be one. Maybe it could have been enough, but I guess the reason I resisted Sully overall is that I never believed that the movie believed in that twist as being something dramatically fruitful. It leans on it very, very heavily. And I think the best way it introduces it and the best thing about this movie is Tom Hanks' performance.
Yes.
He allows this sense of self-doubt to creep in really before we even know that there's this angle to the investigation. These early scenes of Sully in the hotel room where he's essentially been barricaded while the investigation is going on, they're so darkly lit by cinematographer Tom Stern. And Hanks is either sitting at the edge of a bed, hunched over, or at one point he's in the bathroom. There's steam, and he's at the sitting at the edge of the shower on the, at the tub. And you just see that this guy's burdened. And you know without him saying a thing, he's second-guessing himself,
right?
All this is communicated in physical performance. The movie then goes on to reiterate that through dialogue, through the investigator's lines, through Sully himself, who's forced to ask out loud at one point, what if I did below this? In one of the many long, really fruitless conversations on the phone he has with his wife, played by a wasted Laura Linney.
I disagree.
And so I feel that the movie, it had this one hook of trying to find a sense of drama to this story, plays with us for a long time, and then reverts back to being this hagiography, which was one of the problems with American Sniper at the end. And so it really doesn't amount to that interesting of a story.
I wish I could say that I hear what you're saying, but I don't hear what you're saying. You're just completely wrong about this film. And apparently I could have used a page out of Sully's book here because I haven't been at movie reviewing for 40 years, certainly, but long enough to know better than to underestimate a movie. And to use your word surprise, I put off seeing this movie until just before we sat down here to record. I waited till the last possible minute because it suited my schedule better, but also because I was just sure there was no chance this movie was going to surprise me. I didn't envision any possibility that I'd be sitting here having just come from the theater wishing I had more time to develop a case. And it seems I need to make a case for this movie and to make a case for why I think everybody listening needs to go see Sully immediately. But I'm going to do my best because I'm really glad that Oliver Stone show did get pushed back. I honestly would have probably not made it to this movie, Josh, if we weren't talking about it. Very little risk that it wouldn't be worth my 96 minutes, but also very little reward. I had managed to avoid any review, positive or negative, so I had nothing to sway me there. And I'm sure there are even a lot of people listening who probably felt somewhat similar. Maybe they thought, I've had enough of Tom Hanks as America's captain. No matter how great he is at it, he's the ultimate everyday hero on screen. This is another great example of that type of portrayal. Maybe I've had enough of Clint Eastwood as a filmmaker or as a man. All I can say is there are rewards here. This is a really powerful film, and I use that word, powerful, because there were at least four or five moments in it that provoked a really strong visceral response from me. Not the common type of response I get from watching even an action movie or something where you are maybe a little bit more in doubt about the outcome. It rarely happens, and I can speak earnestly without embarrassment about how powerful this film is because I think of the restraint that Eastwood shows. And maybe this gets back to that notion of him again as a craftsman and you mentioning that he could be on autopilot. I don't get that sense here, but I do get the sense that he's very efficient with his storytelling. And you have to give credit to the screenwriter here, of course, as well. Todd Komornicki, a new name to me. There's just nothing contrived about any of these moments that I'm thinking of or the movie overall. In some cases, there's actually nothing inherently emotional about them. It's moments like the one during the landing, where the flight attendants all sit down. They've been trying to kind of calm the passengers. And then the captain says, brace for impact. They sit down and their training kicks in. And they instantly start chanting, brace, brace, brace. Head down, stay down. that hit me, and I think it will hit a lot of viewers, partly because you can't help in a way to envision yourself in that situation and hearing that and how scared you would be, how that would make you feel, but also because the whole movie is just such an ode, again, I'm going to use the word, to professionalism. These flight attendants, the air traffic controller we meet, the ferry captain, he gives all these people just enough time. We see them all and many others going about their routines. They all cross off their checklists. They see a situation and they respond. There's no psychology. There's no angst. They're just doing what they do. They're doing what their job asks them to do. And I think that Eastwood really makes this point effectively through simply depicting the action. And even in the most potentially triumphant moments, and there are some here, I don't think there's anything really triumphant about how he depicts them. The music, Christian Jacob, his score here is wonderful, mainly because I think it's minimally employed. A lot of times Eastwood just lets the dramatic moments play out with no music whatsoever. That shows he's obviously very confident in the material and the people who are doing the heavy lifting. The cinematography doesn't betray any kind of overt crowd-pleasing or trying to make us feel that triumph. Everything is just very workmanlike. They're workmanlike, the characters we see on screen, not heroic. And the sum of all that, the sum of all that work, the sum of all that action stunned me. Honestly, I was stunned, I guess, at how often this movie stunned me. Had no expectation of that whatsoever.
It's definitely a recurring theme. I think Sully even says at the end to his co-pilot, played by Aaron Eckhart, is something along the lines of, we did our job, mm-hmm. right? And yeah, you can see that through a lot of those characters you mentioned. I do think that the crash sequence itself is really well handled.
Yeah.
It's very harrowing. And yeah, I am not saying that this movie manipulates things or tries mm-hmm. to wind the audience up at all. No, that's not what I'm accusing it of. And I think that crashing is really well handled. I especially like the shot towards the end after Sully is the last one to leave the plane. Mm-hmm. And he's on the ferry and kind of rising up on the stairs to get to the top of the ferry. And in the background, you see the plane mm-hmm. slowly sinking into the water. So even though it is very workmanlike, there are definitely some moments that stand out mm-hmm. in terms of the filmmaking. I think for me overall, it's just not that interesting of a story. And when it's being told in a way that is workmanlike, we're not given an added level of interest. And I don't mean this to, you know, to judge that it's not an interesting story. We shouldn't care about it. But I needed Sully to give me a reason. Why am I going to care about this now any more than I may have cared about it when it first broke on the news and I followed it at that time? It gives us some information about the investigation, mm-hmm. but that's about it. And that's a red herring in terms of an exploration of heroism, really. I think this is not – you were right when you named the films that Eastwood has done at the beginning, Flags of Our Fathers, Unforgiven, and American Sniper, exploring heroism. Those are the ones this is in the tradition of, and it's much less interesting than all of those to that degree. And the reason is because there is no conflict here.
I don't know how you could watch this movie and not see conflict from the first frame
until
the end.
You see conflict in Hank's performance.
Yes.
But the movie does not follow through on that. This investigation, it's never a question. And another example is –
I disagree completely.
The board investigating this mm-hmm. is portrayed from the very first scene as a lynch mob, as a conspiratorial group. We never quite understand why are they going after him.
I don't completely disagree with that notion.
Why are they going after him so hard?
He's got no ally on that board. I mean, that is covered. That is covered. And let me just jump in real quick and say, Josh, that I agree that I wish they were a little more human. They seem out to get him from the very beginning. And that reduces
because that's
the conflict
how the because that's
bit.
How the movie wants to
potentially,
see
potentially, but
and
Josh,
wants us to see
but
them.
But Josh, here's where I disagree with you a little bit. What I did find by the end of it is I understood where they were coming from, and I don't want to get into the finale of
they
this movie.
They have to do their job.
But
yes,
it's not just no job. No, Josh. It's not just that they have to do their job. It's that they have ample evidence that supports their theory of how this went down. And that's no different than the version, the narrative in the mind of what we see from Aaron Eckhart or the narrative that Sully himself has. They both have reason to believe, and they actually do have reason to believe, they are absolutely incontrovertibly correct. And when you have that
yes.
sense, then that is going to lead you to behave in that manner.
And you are describing a movie that has way more tension between those two points than this movie has.
Hmm.
It was a screenwriting contrivance to get this board to be against Sully in a way that isn't as natural. So
not
we
at
ever
all.
Wonder how are things going to turn out? There's much more at stake here in the interior struggle of Sully.
Yes.
And that is where the movie's strength is. But that gets thrown out or overridden by the way this board is portrayed and the way the investigation unfolds, so that I never really felt that tension. I mean, where – for the stakes that you value so much in drama –
And they're all over this
where
film.
Were they
well,
here?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Josh, because this notion that there's no drama – in this film or not enough to sustain this movie, that there aren't enough stakes.
Outside of the crash sequence, because that's one that we obviously are going to have a stake in.
It's completely lost on me. And that sequence in particular, I was honestly hoping that we wouldn't even see it. I was really glad, first of all, the movie didn't open with it. I loved the touch of it opening after that's happened.
Yeah, there's a nice little
fake out. I expected the movie to ease us in the credit sequence and everyone's getting ready for their day. And then, oh, whoops, look at how all hell broke loose. I thought that's what it was going to do. And by the time the movie does actually getting around to playing that whole crash sequence, I was ready for it. I was actually eager to see it. So I love how
Eastwood
handled
that. Because not much else is going on.
But
it came as a relief to me.
That's where I disagree
with you. It's like we need something to happen at this point because otherwise I know absolutely where this story is going.
I disagree completely.
Not because of the real world narrative, but because of how it's being told by these filmmakers.
I almost was hoping, oh, wait, don't get me to the crash just yet. Don't get me to the landing just yet.
Because what were you wondering?
Because I wanted the movie to continue to be about that inner struggle. I wanted it to continue to be about those conversations and the little chinks in the armor of doubt that kept creaking in. If you go back, I looked at a clip online where he's talking to the NTSB board, that first conversation after it happens.
Today, we begin with our operation and human performance investigation on the crash of US Airways Flight 1549.
Water landing.
Captain?
This was not a crash and it wasn't a ditching. We knew what we were trying to execute here. It was not a, it's not a crash. It was a forced water landing.
Why didn't you attempt to return to LaGuardia?
There simply was not enough altitude.
The depiction of Sully here, whether it's accurate or not, by Hanks is one of a character who you would never describe as being full of hubris, not someone who's cocky in any way. But there is a great moment where he says, without hesitation, I eyeballed it.
You eyeballed it.
Yes.
In that moment, again, not hubris, not overconfidence, but confident enough in himself and who he is that it doesn't even occur to him that he may have done something wrong in that moment. And it's only as new information is revealed that he has to reckon with what he just went through and whether or not he did act according to his duty. That's the Sully we see for most of this film. And I honestly could have just watched more conversations between him and Aaron Eckhart. I could have watched more conversations with him and the board. But that drama, that conflict of everything he has lived his entire life believing in and believing in himself, seeing himself as a pilot, seeing himself as a captain, now could be all thrown away. You can't have more dramatic stakes. Forget whether or not he's going to be exonerated, even though I still think that's interesting and watching how that plays out. The facts and the details will make that compelling, not whether or not he's exonerated. We know how that's going to play out, but how it plays out is interesting enough. But what's more interesting is whether or not a man who has a very firm grasp on his identity the day this event happens, and then the guy we meet in the aftermath is someone who that's completely fractured, and whether or not he's going to be able to fly again, whether or not he's going to ever see himself as the man he saw himself to be before, that for me is powerful stuff.
I felt that in the early scenes with Hank's performance when he's not saying anything. I didn't feel it in the multiple times other characters, including Katie Couric, in a dream he has, asks him, are you a hero or a fraud directly? I mean, when that theme, when I'm given it so gently and beautifully by a nonverbal performance in the first 5 minutes, and then I have it repeated to me in dialogue for the rest of the 80 minutes or whatever it is, you know, that's just not as compelling to me. Now, the nuts and bolts stuff, I agree, is very good. When they get into the hearings and some of the dynamics and some of the decisions that were made and the conversations with Eckhart, I thought were good too. But that's the stuff of that's like something that should be in a video exhibit at an aviation history museum. Okay, this is not the stuff of drama. Those are all good details.
Every one of those conversations is full of drama. It's them questioning themselves, sorting through a situation in real time. That's
all,
acting.
All four
that's,
of the flight
drama.
Simulations that we got during the trial scene at the end were
somehow
drama.
I knew you were going to bring up the
like
repetition of that.
It ends
if you're
in
invested
like a courtroom
in the movie,
scene.
If you're invested in the movie, you want to see each of
those
iterations.
It was dramatically inert.
I couldn't wait to see each of those dramatizations play out, because I was that connected to this movie and the conflict.
There has to be another way of envisioning, of communicating that information and getting it to work as a piece of drama.
Maybe.
Beyond sitting through 15 minutes of flight simulations.
The details do matter. The details,
right,
the
facts matter at a museum.
The facts matter. Oh, okay. I'm sure a museum can have a perfectly compelling dramatic video playing as well. I asked you at the beginning about the man and the material, and I do want to just mention this briefly because you want to talk about a terrible Clint Eastwood movie that I've never watched in its entirety, but I'm pretty sure I've seen almost all of it, mainly because when it comes on HBO, it's so terrible I can't avert my eyes, and it's Trouble with the Curve. The movie he made where he's a baseball scout.
Did he direct that one?
I'm pretty sure he did. He's a baseball scout. Amy Adams is his daughter, who is this high-powered lawyer, but who has been raised in the game, and she helps him on the road because he's losing his eyesight. So how can he be a baseball scout? And of course, the industry is changing, and it's now all about analytics and computers and numbers. But he's the aged scout. It's just really terrible because, of course, it's about this whole notion that a computer can't tell you. It can give you statistics, but it can't tell you whether or not a guy has heart, for example, right? So we get this glorification of a dinosaur scout who can't see anymore, but he's so good that apparently, because of all of his experience, he can hear that a player can't hit the curveball because of the way his bat swings through the air. Okay, it's just totally ridiculous. There's validity to the case he's making, the case Eastwood's making, but he sets up a straw man, and nothing about the movie really reflects the actual conflict inherent in trying to evaluate athletic talent. I do think he's found it here. He's finally found that marriage of the material with this theme that he's exploring, because Sully, as a captain, certainly passes the eye tests. He ultimately passes the algorithm test as well. There's a process to validate his actions, both in the fact that 155 souls walked onto that plane and 155 walk off. And then we do get some more information that shows that, well, he might be validated as a captain scientifically, too. I do think there's something there that does reflect back on those scenes where, to you, it felt like wasted time, but it was crucial to actually see every variation on this to rule definitively that he doesn't just pass the eye test as a captain, but he actually made the right decision. He is a great pilot. I think Eastwood wants us, he clearly wants us to be aware of both of those at once.
I was just looking it up, and Trouble with the Curve, it's directed by Robert Lorenz.
Okay.
But yeah, it does sound like it fits right in with Eastwood's, you know, exploration of these kind of figures. I wanted to ask you about the end credit sequence, and not that the entire movie should be written off just because you didn't like this. I didn't like the one that Eastwood did in American Sniper, but I think they're similar in that they become these moments to offer actual applause for the real life person on which the film is based. Mm. Christ Kyle in the case of American Sniper, and Sullenberger here, where we see over the credits the actual Sullenberger in a hangar meeting with some of the passengers. And it's don't get me wrong, it is heartwarming, and it is deserved what these people say about him. And there's this connection that they have that is really intriguing to watch. Again, maybe in a documentary. But my question has more to do with how Eastwood has handled a few of his recent films, and again, this idea of how he explores heroism. It makes me wonder why he completely undercuts any ambiguity that the previous film had. That's one of the things I liked. You didn't find it in American Sniper, but
no.
I thought there was ambiguity there, and I thought the epilogue completely undercut that. This, similarly, completely undercuts, for different reasons and maybe better ones, the supposed tension that we have with the board and questioning Sully's decision-making in this film by offering a similar scene. And it made me think, you know, why in something like Unforgiven is he willing to sit with the ambiguity over the character and make us really wrestle a little bit more whether this main character is a hero. Now, I happened to see Sully with my dad, and he threw out there right away, you know, well, these are real life people. And he asked me, can you think of a real life anti-hero that Eastwood might need to make a movie where he sticks with that all the way through the end? Now, some people might say Chris Kyle is an anti-hero. I don't know. But I'm just curious as to why Eastwood seems to have, with his last two films now, gone in this direction with an epilogue.
I can't really comment because I don't really sit through credit sequences except for maybe the first 30 seconds or so, and that's all I did here. So
yeah,
I saw some of the imagery, but
that.
I didn't see anything after that. I haven't really ever formed a real strong opinion about when movies do that. There are times where I know it's worked for me. There are times where I know it hasn't. But in general, I kind of wish real-life movies didn't give us any post information at all, even when they come up with text on the screen.
Yeah.
Here, it's only two sentences. It's restrained, again, like the movie, and it's fine. I don't think it takes away from anything. The last thing we see is the text of these two sentences on screen. But could the movie have been just fine and maybe even a little bit more powerful had ended without those two sentences? Yeah, it probably could have, but I don't know what followed.
Yeah, well, you know, just in general, then maybe for me, I feel like, and maybe this is unfair, but when a movie does that, it's sort of laying its cards on the table and saying, okay, we've teased you, or maybe not teased, but we've played with the idea of who this person was and the different ways of looking at him and allowing these different lenses. But now here, especially in American Sniper, you know, this is how we want you to leave the theater feeling
yeah.
about this person. And I just find it much more interesting if we're left with that ambiguity, which is something that Unforgiven obviously
I don't disagree, but this is a conversation for another time, partly because I would have a lot more to say if we were talking about Snowden. Because speaking of movies about reluctant heroes,
mm-hmm, sure,
if you want to
yeah.
see Snowden as a hero, real life story, one big incident or event that then changes the scope of his life and, of course, really American history as well, it has a similar sort of ending with lots of clips and news clippings and various things that you see that then go and show us the real Edward Snowden. So that will be another point of conversation perhaps between us then. But just in closing, let me mention two other moments I really like that I'm guessing one maybe just didn't have any impact on you, and the other one you probably hated. And it's the little touches as I talk about people going through their checklists and going about their routines. And Eastwood just taking the time for those moments. How about when this whole incident has now played out, everyone is safely off, including his crew, and Sully goes back to the cockpit and he gathers his things.
Yeah.
I love the fact that he does take that time, almost because I think just out of habit. He doesn't know what else to do. It's not like he's going back to get anything crucial, like a crucial log or something. He just goes back, he gets his jacket, he gets his notebook or whatever, and he walks off the plane. I think because it's just what you do when you land, whether you land in an emergency fashion or not.
Yeah,
I love that.
That whole sequence is really strong. Also the touch, and maybe this is what you're getting to, after they're back on shore, he refuses. I mean, he's freezing like they all are.
Right.
And he refuses to move on until he gets the count of all the passengers.
Yeah.
And that, again, speaks to not only his nature, his character, but his professionalism.
Yeah. The other moment I did really appreciate is the fact that Eastwood introduced at just the right level and amount the specter of 9/11. When that plane is later, as we see it, is cruising down
sure.
the Hudson River, it's passing the Manhattan skyline. You can't help, of course, as a viewer or as someone in Manhattan on that day, you would be seeing that plane and you would instantly be flashing back to
yeah.
something the opposite of heroic happening.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And we see it in the form of one character glimpsing it, just someone we don't know from the rest of the movie. And then it cuts to like a boardroom and we see someone get up and look. And that's it. He looks out the window. And I think everything we need to know in that moment of that character looking out the window gives us that story of what people seeing that plane, how harrowing that must have been. I love that. Now, did I need later a character actually specifically referencing 9/11? No, but I will forgive the movie that trespass.
Well, and there are also, I mean, it does hit its points repeatedly. There are also one, possibly two visions or dreams Sully has in which he imagines if he had tried to make the runway
mm-hmm.
and instead the whole plane goes into a building.
I
think that's the first time 9/11 is referenced
sure,
because we see it going.
Yeah.
And that was,
but from
you know,
an outsider
really,
perspective, yeah,
really
as a bystander.
Jarring to me to suddenly once again put those two things in context of each other, which have since 2009 maybe drifted apart in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie does remind you of that. You're right. I would agree. Doesn't need to remind us maybe four or five times.
My apologies to Clint Eastwood for suggesting he directed the horrible movie, The Trouble with the Curve. I hope I have made up for it by urging everyone to ignore you, Josh, and rush out and see Sully. You
go
might
see
just
Sully.
Be surprised and rewarded.
You know, that's fine. I'm fine if people go see
I know
Sully.
You are.
It's just like I'm fine if people go see Morris from America. I'm just crabby lately. Maybe
okay.
that's it.
And on that note, speaking of crabby people, Clint Eastwood, his latest Sully is out now in wide release. If you see it or have seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Up next, we'll share the results of the film spotting poll, A Robot Deathmatch. Even if robots aren't alive and they really have nothing to lose.
Are you saying there's no stakes?
Exactly. Anyway, stay with us.
I was thinking that the world was gonna change. And all my friends and family's debts were paid. But it's not about the money that you make. You can't make me. I had another dream about the world. Everything was the same as it was before. The rich keep killing off the poor, but they can't take me. They can't take me.
Dearest Isabel, I can't stop thinking about the time I spent with you.
Dearest Tom, when I first saw you, I felt like I knew you, and I couldn't stop seeing my life with you.
To be loved by you allowed me to feel again.
A couple of lovely people acting lovingly in love in the trailer for The Light Between Oceans, a movie, alas, Josh, we still haven't seen, despite the fact that it stars Film Spotting Madness champion Michael Fassbender and his real-life love, Alicia Vikander. We will get to a little bit more talk about that pair as we share our poll results in a moment. We did have a couple notes we wanted to share, including some more ticket giveaways for our Chicagoland listeners. We've got The Dressmaker, starring Kate Winslet, also Operation Avalanche. These are all movies coming out here in the next week or two in Chicago, playing in limited release, and we have got passes so you can see it in advance and for free. You can enter if you are interested at filmspotting.net. Also, tickets to give away for a new movie called Kicks. Our wonderful producer, Sam Van Halgren, has been pushing this on us. He hasn't seen it yet, but he's curious about it, thinks it might be a Golden Brick contender based on what he knows about it, and hopefully we will be able to make the time for it here in the coming weeks. But that is also going to have an advanced screening here in Chicago, and we're going to give away some passes to it.
I've seen the trailer for Kicks. I'm familiar with The Dressmaker, but what is Operation Avalanche? I don't know that
one. I'm not aware of it starring anybody super well-known or being directed by anyone super well-known. I'm going to just say Clint Eastwood directed it because okay. I just want to give him credit or discredit for everything. But I know it's set during the 60s and a couple of CIA agents are investigating a possible Russian spy within NASA.
Oh,
I think that's
okay.
The setup. So
got it.
Sounds pretty interesting. Again, if you want to see it and you want to see it for free and before it comes out, enter at filmspotting.net. Also here in Chicago, Josh, I did want to put out a quick plug for a project by a Chicago writer and director. Her name's Lucia Morrow, and she's got a new feature film called One Year Later, which is about a woman journeying to the Italian Alps after she completes cancer treatment, and it's going to play here September 18th in Chicago at Loyola University Medical Center's new research facility. So just a good tie-in, September being National Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month, and the proceeds from that screening are going to go to cancer research. So if you want to learn more and donate, you can do that at oneyearlaterfilm.com. Speaking of Chicago events, we've been teasing for the past few weeks that we are, for real this time, going to have a live show.
This is our apology
for
moving the August live show.
That's right. So
it's really
going to
happen this time.
For show 600, but it's going to happen for show 613 or something.
Sure.
It's not going to commemorate anything, but there is upcoming, Josh, the Chicago Podcast Festival. If you follow us on Twitter or follow some other podcasters on Twitter, you might have seen some information about this already. But November 17th through the 19th here in Chicago at three different Chicago venues, a bunch of podcasts, a plethora of podcasts, and not just Chicago-based podcasts are going to be doing their shows live. And on Friday the 18th, we're going to do a little show with our friends Matt and Allison from Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. They're going to come in from New York City. They're going to open for us, essentially. They're going to do their thing, and then we're going to do our thing, though we only have 2 hours total, so we're going to do an abbreviated version of our thing.
This is going to be a real challenge for us.
I'm looking forward to it, actually. And then our friends, The Next Picture Show, all part of this Film Spotting family of podcasts, they're going to be performing in combination with another podcast on Saturday the 19th at a different venue. So there's some information, again, out about this already, and tickets are actually on sale now for our shows. So we'll link to that and give you more information in our show notes, chicagopodcastfestival.org.
We've got your whole weekend planned for you, right? 18th, come see us. Come see Matt and Allison.
Yep.
And then 19th, go see the other guys, and you're all set.
You're all set. You have your film fix.
You've certainly met Allison. In person.
I have.
I have not.
I have at Sundance when Matt and Allison were still doing the old IFC podcast.
Yeah.
I remember going to their room at the hotel. They didn't share a room. They had separate rooms. But
yeah, sure.
They had a room where they were recording podcasts,
uh-huh.
And I appeared on one of those IFC podcasts. So I certainly
That's
met
been
Allison
a while then.
Yeah, that was like 2007 or 8.
Well, I can't wait to meet her in person finally.
It will be fun. That brings us to our poll questions. A couple of weeks back, we had The Light Between Oceans penciled in as a possible review, Fassbender, Vikander, director Derek Cianfrance, based on a best-selling novel. There are plenty of reasons to be curious about this movie, but again, have yet to see it. And with all this Oliver Stone stuff happening, not sure we're going to be able to make time. But in anticipation of that review, we asked you this pressing question. I mean, all of humanity,
yes,
or non-humanity really rests on the answer to this question. Who played the robot better? Which star of The Light Between Oceans played the robot better? Michael Fassbender as David in Prometheus, or Alicia Vikander as Ava in Ex Machina? Josh, how did it come out?
Not even close. Not even close at all. 80% for Alicia Vikander. That's the right way to go.
I called it. I knew it was going to be a disaster, even with all the love that listeners have for Michael Fassbender, and rightfully so. Phil says, wait, Fassbender is losing a Film Spotting poll. Dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Pretty much it.
Yep.
Peter in Boston says, sorry, Adam, I didn't find too much in Fassbender's David that didn't already come to the surface in the previous Alien films. David is a flawed being with an agenda that comes from a flawed creator. Vikander's Ava is a superior life form from a flawed creator that slowly takes control over her surroundings. Her interdependence on human beings is more tenuous than David's.
Yeah, and Peter went on to give up some spoilers, and for those of you who haven't seen Ex Machina, I don't want to spoil it, but certainly our perceptions of all the characters in the movie, not just Ava, change. They're shifting throughout that whole movie, as we touched on when we discussed it, but especially by the end of the film, it really gives you a completely different perspective on everyone. And I'm not surprised Ava and Vikander is getting so much love here in the poll. Mike H. says, as one of the seemingly literal handful of people on planet Earth that thinks Prometheus was a perfectly fine and thematically sound film, I'm with you, Mike. It pains me to have to pass up an increasingly rare opportunity to give it any small gesture of support, but this poll is a runaway for good reason. Ex Machina totally hinges on Vikander single-handedly pulling off a few key scenes, which she does, so that's that.
Is that the way Prometheus is considered? I thought I was on the outs by not liking it.
No, you were definitely in line with conventional wisdom on that one.
Okay, look at you. Mm-hmm. You and Mike H. How about that? We also heard from Johan Andersson from Gislaved, Sweden.
Sure.
I think. I feel this is an unfair poll since Fassi is the only one acting.
This is so good.
Vikander is like all other of us Swedes, a real robot made by Volvo, programmed to take over the world. And I must say, we're doing quite well since we now even have crushed the biggest Film Spotting star of them all. Thanks for a good show and helping us taking over the world. Johan T1000 Andersson, over and out.
I mean, she is kind of perfect, certainly as an actress. She's wonderful.
I don't think real robots say over and out, though. I'm suspicious about this.
Well, that brings us to our new poll question, in which we segue from a question about two actors who have received no shortage of attention and adoration to a question about an actor who, despite his fame, Josh, and despite the fact that he does have two Oscars, one for Best Supporting Actor and one for Best Lead Actor, he's perhaps not appreciated enough. That is one Denzel Washington.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case with him.
The Magnificent Seven remake opens next weekend. Washington in the Yul Brynner part, along with Chris Pratt and Ethan Hawke. Our review we think will come a week after that.
But you know how these things go.
And again, I can't promise what I want to promise, but we think we have something pretty great lined up for this top five, tying in with Magnificent Seven. We're going to pay tribute to Denzel properly, hopefully, with our top five Denzel Washington performances. And that is as good a transition as any into our question. And Sam didn't respond to this. He's been a little bit scattered lately. I think he's taking a little vacation, and he didn't put
the
in the
poor
normal,
guy is getting a break is what's happening.
Yeah, he's
happening.
Getting a break, and he didn't put in his normal 8 hours into the wording of this poll question. He is always in favor of using the phrasing for questions like this. What's your favorite, not
right.
What's the best?
Yes.
Because they do connote different things. And he's right. And I instinctually tend to go with best. He instinctually tends to go with favorite. And I really do think with Denzel, that wording is going to affect the results. So Sam is the one this time who said best. And when I challenged him on it, he didn't respond. So which one are we going with, Josh?
I think this is already a faulty poll is what we've learned.
There you go. I'm already providing the out so that we can redo it next week, which we might
exactly.
do. I mean, we could just post it.
Let's do
twice.
Both.
Let's do both.
Let's do a favorite poll
okay.
and a best poll.
I am in. We're putting
both
polls up at filmspotting.net, and we're going to see.
And let's see what the result is.
Why just speculate about how the experiment will play out? Let's conduct the experiment.
You know what? Why have two polls? There's got to be a third we can get out of this.
I'm willing to stop at two. Why don't we phrase it? The choices aren't going to change either way. So what is Denzel Washington's best performance? What's your favorite performance? The options are.
Flight. He Got Game. Inside Man. Malcolm X. All three Spike Lee movies. Training Day, and we're going to offer other.
So if you're listening right now and you're thinking, what about his appearances in Tony Scott movies like Deja Vu and Man on Fire, or as Easy Rollins in Devil in a Blue Dress, or The Hurricane, or Philadelphia, or Glory, of course, which he did win that Best Supporting Actor Oscar. We kind of left Glory out because it is supporting. But overall, we left all those out because our gut tells us that those five with other are really the top candidates, that we think it's going to come out that way. We know others going to get some votes. We know people are going to come up with movies. Some are probably even going to say Virtuosity and God Bless You.
I don't see that happening.
You can put that in other and go ahead and explain yourself. Maybe we'll get a couple Courage Under Fires, but we really think those are the ones that are going to contend.
So before Sam went AWOL, he asked this on Twitter, and my instinctive response.
Instinctive.
Well, it might have been instinctual as well, was to put Glory in there. I'm not sure if I'll stick with that,
that
though, because I didn't mention Devil in a Blue Dress, and I'm starting to regret that already. So whichever poll question you answer, or if you do both, this is going to be difficult.
It is. So I'm not going to put you on the spot right now. Do you want to wait?
I'm still in process.
There you go. We're actually going to do this
top five. And now my process has
five.
Been doubled.
All right. So we can't wait to hear what you think in response to both polls. Vote now at filmspotting.net. If you leave a comment, and we hope you do, please let us know where you're listening from, especially if you write in with a treatise on the virtues of virtuosity. Let us know where you're writing from
it's out there.
We can stay away. A little bit of melancholy music there from You, the Living, one of the seven films that made up our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon. It has concluded. We concluded it last week with a discussion of the Icelandic film Rams. And we really did from the beginning, Josh, set out to build this marathon, since it is about geography, build it around countries, and then also build it around those countries' primary auteurs. And we recognize that the word primary and auteur both are debatable. You can question our choices and throw in others if you would like. But we knew from the very beginning, really the impetus for the marathon was we wanted to get in some Roy Anderson films from Sweden. You, the Living, Songs from the Second Floor were his two movies. We wanted to watch some Aki Kaurismäki. I think you've already seen one of his films.
Yeah, I saw Man Without a Past, but definitely had been meaning to see Le Havre. had never gotten around to it, so we did that.
He's a name that has been on our marathons list of possible subjects for quite some time, so we did watch those two films, The Man Without a Past and Le Havre. We watched Suzanne Beer's In a Better World from Denmark, Bent Hammer's 1001 Grams from Norway, and then Grimur Hakko Narsen. I know I'm supposed to let you say that one, Josh.
You
you're
did so pretty
good at it. Yeah, that's the film from Iceland that we just talked about, and Hakko Narsen is a pretty new filmmaker, the most emerging of that bunch. All the others pretty established. He'd made one previous feature called Summerland and a documentary called A Pure Heart. We'll get to some more thoughts, including thoughts from listeners on Rams here as we get to our awards. And we do this with every marathon, and we always try to come up with a clever name. The music there really was your dead giveaway that we were going with. The Sad Tubas. Mm-hmm. It just seems so perfect. It encapsulates that deadpan spirit of so many of these Scandinavian films.
And gave us a reason to hear those tubas again.
That's right.
Which I can't get enough of.
No, you certainly appreciated them much more than I did within the context of that film, You the Living. And we'll get to some alternatives that we considered in a moment. I do just want to say, for a lot of people out there who sent us some feedback, who gave us suggestions at the top of this marathon, and we've read a little bit of this as we've made it through the seven movies, nobody really questioned our Roy Anderson choices. Most people seem to agree that those two films, You the Living and Songs from the Second Floor, which are part of a trilogy, were the way to go. But a number of people did suggest there were maybe better Karasmaki options. 1989's Leningrad Cowboys Go America.
Some of his earlier ones,
yeah, that
people
came
said.
Up. And I was really fascinated by that movie in terms of what I read about it, but it just wasn't available. And that is one of those things that we always consider with these marathons is, can we get our hands on it? And then, depending on how much of a struggle that is, are people listening going to get their hands on it? And are they going to participate? So we want to encourage participation. And with that, we had to leave that film off. But one of those listeners, Alice Quinn, Q-I-N, she wrote in and said, apart from You the Living being one of my favorite films, I wanted to make a case for Aki Kaurismäki's Leningrad Cowboys. It might not be as important as his other works. It might even be seen as downright ridiculous, but it is definitely the most I've ever laughed each time I've seen it. It is certainly my favorite road trip movie, featuring a fantastic cameo by Jim Jarmusch as a used car salesman. So throwing that out there, if you're encouraged to see other Kaurismäki films, if you can get your hands on it, that might be a way to go. We definitely heard from people after our kind of mixed reaction. I was more mixed than you, but the Suzanne Beer film, In a Better World, I think we were maybe seduced a little bit by it being the foreign language Oscar winner that year, I think 2011 or 2012. A lot of people wrote in and said After the Wedding is a much better film. I can say now that you're right. I had seen that movie previously. I think that's a 2007 movie, so that's why we left it out of the marathon. If there was one country and one filmmaker, one auteur that probably got screwed here, don't you think it's Norway and Bent Hammer? Because 1001 Grams was the movie we were both the toughest on, by far, out of the seven. And I think we, again, touch on this a little bit as we set it up with some listener feedback, but a lot of people said Kitchen Stories is a much better film, or O. Horton. And Kitchen Stories, we just couldn't get. Mm-hmm. O. Horton was on Netflix, and maybe that's how we should have gone in retrospect. But
do you remember what year O. Horton was? Because I know we were also considering
2007.
Oh, okay. So that would have counted. Yeah,
it would have
counted as contemporary.
We just aired.
You know, when you're doing these also, we haven't seen them yet, so it's a bit of a crapshoot.
Totally.
And you could go with the conventional wisdom on one of them, but I can guarantee you if we had not liked that one, we would have had somebody saying, well, you should really watch 1001 Grams. So, so in a way, these are jumping off points as well. We certainly aren't closing the book on any of these filmmakers. If anything, when we do a marathon like this, it gives us more impetus to seek out their other works, and hopefully listeners will do the same thing.
Yeah, indeed. So the name, The Sad Tubas, we love it when we get listener suggestions. In this case, we just like The Sad Tubas so much that we went with it. We thought it was appropriate, had a nice ring to it, if you will. But that doesn't mean we didn't get some good suggestions. Adam Hellis in Gavla, Sweden, said, as always, thank you guys for a great show. As a Swede, it has been great fun listening to your Nordic movie marathon. I have a suggestion regarding a name. How about keeping it simple and naming it the Nordic Cross? As you might know, all Nordic flags have a cross in their design, and it's one of the things that shows unity between our five nations. And please, no references to Vikings in the name if you go with another name.
We didn't do that, Adam.
No,
so.
I mean, we're ugly Americans, but we're not that ugly. And I do like the Nordic Cross. It works especially if you say, and the Nordic Cross for Best Picture goes to.
Ooh, that does
that
sound
good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But we didn't go that way.
Well, Jared Sorensen suggested the Bragis.
Mm-hmm.
That's the name for the Norse god of Skaldic poetry, Bragi.
Bragi.
So I maybe mispronounced Bragis, Bragi, and Skaldic there. Sorry, Derek.
The trifecta. That leaves us with our last but not least suggestion from one Dave Larson. Sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Palos Heights, Illinois.
Norwegian name.
As a half-breed Scandinavian, Dave writes, here's my suggestion for the Nordic Cinema Marathon Prize, the John Ford Award. That's Ford, F-J-O-R-D.
Yeah, that sounds like my dad.
He's got a good sense of humor. How come you didn't get any of it, Josh?
Very funny.
So thank you, Dave. Thank you, Jared, Adam, and everyone who sent in a suggestion, everyone who did play along with this marathon. We like to cap these off by reflecting on our favorite moments, our favorite performances, and then ultimately naming a best picture. So, Josh, why don't you get us started? It's not the Nordic Cross. It is the SAG Tuba Award, the first one going to our favorite supporting performance.
I'm going to give the SAG Tuba to a pair of performers. I'm going to let them share
cheater.
This. I know, but they come from the same movie.
What's Cheater and Skaldic?
You're going to hate this even more because it's from a movie you didn't care for, Suzanne Beer's In a Better World. It's really an ensemble film overall as it explores the dynamics among these two families when their boys meet at school. And I am going to give the award to those two boys. Marcus Rygaard as Elias, a lonely 10-year-old who is being mercilessly bullied at school. And then William Nielsen as Christian. He's the cocky new kid who comes to Elias's aid, takes him under his wing, but then takes revenge on the bullies of the world beyond school with a surprising amount of violence. I did go for this movie largely because the metaphor worked better here than in some of the other films in this marathon, but also because of the interplay between these two child actors. Really strong. I liked the way Rygaard's eager innocence was this foil for Nielsen's disturbing anger. And together they just gave me the emotional linchpin that helped the movie overall mm-hmm. resonate for me.
Before I get to my pick, I do want to say for anyone who's listening to this right this moment and thinking, I have no idea what movies they're talking about, who any of these people are, what all this Nordic talk is about, I will just note that if you go to filmspotting.net, you click on marathons, you'll see a link there for contemporary Nordic cinema. It lists the 7 movies we watched, the titles, the years they came out. It links to our discussions of them. So you can see those titles. And not only that, you can see where you can watch them, the different platforms that they're on.
And we should have these awards up there by the time this
yes,
show is out too.
We will, absolutely. So I thought I was being clever. I thought I was going out on a limb by going with a performance from In a Better World for my best supporting performance. And it turns out you trumped me. Not only did you beat me to the surprise, but you had 2 people in there. I just went with Elias. I went with Marcus Rygaard.
Okay.
We talked about that moment when he sees that kindred spirit in Christian and that uneasy but still very warm smile that he gives him. He's really a heartbreaking character, and the performance doesn't ever try to break your heart. And he's a fascinating character. It's a good performance, so I went that route. But a couple others then I'll honorably mention. It's very hard to give any love to the Roy Anderson movies here because they're all such vast ensembles.
Yeah.
They're all bits and pieces of scenes that you really can't single out anybody as a lead or a supporting performer. That's not the case in the Kaurismäki ensembles. He's got a recurring performer we saw in Kati Utinen.
Mm-hmm.
She's Irma in Man Without a Past. She's Arledi in La Havre. I think that's probably her better performance, but I like her in both films. And I also really like Michael Persbrandt, the doctor who is the father to Elias, if I'm remembering
yes.
correctly, in A Better World.
The parents in
the
film are all very good as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, you're right. Trina Dearholm as Marianne, the wife, the estranged wife and mother to Elias, they're both really, really good. Ulrich Thompson as Klaus, the father to Christian. And then finally, I guess you'd probably have to give some love to Theodore Juliusson as Kitty in Rams.
Speaking of Rams,
mm-hmm.
should I move on to my lead performance?
Yeah, let's
okay.
do it.
Well, this is also my winner for best name of the marathon.
For sure.
Gummy.
Yeah.
The main brother here, played by, here's the best name, Sigurjonsson.
Yep.
Really strong performance. And here he's the younger brother of these feuding brothers in Rams, the one we follow most closely. So we get to know him the best. I do feel a little bit like maybe I'm falling for the trap I accuse Oscar voters of falling for, because Sigurjonsson does get 2 big breakdown scenes in this movie, these very emotive scenes. I found them to be very devastating.
Yeah, they are.
And they did let me into the inner turmoil that's going on beneath this craggy exterior.
They're pretty small. They're still pretty small by Oscar standards, let's say.
That is true.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe in the context of these very interior, underplayed characters we've seen throughout this marathon, it does stand out. And I wanted to bring something up while we're on the subject of the two brothers here with Rams that we got into having to do with the root of their feud. We got a note from a listener who had a question about that. Brian Shea wrote, "I really enjoyed listening to your takes on Rams and largely agree with everything you had to say. I did find it interesting, though, that you both seemed to agree that it was relatively clear why the feud was going on between Gummy and Kitty. I suspect your allusion is to the conversation between Gummy and the lawyer regarding why all the land is in his name, but I suspected it went further than that. Kitty seems to be a malcontent throughout most of the movie, and he doesn't appear to have any friends at all. I'm thinking in particular about the scene in the restaurant where Gummy is surrounded by the rest of his friends in the town at a table, and he looks to see Kitty dining alone. To me, this suggests that perhaps Kitty's abrasive personality is the true source of the feud, but of course it's never really addressed. Perhaps you could shed some light on why you think the fact that Gummy and Kitty's father tried to disinherit Kitty would have led Kitty to refuse to speak to Gummy for 40 years. Such an action might lead to resentment, sure, but to not speak for that long? I could understand Kitty being angry with his father over it, but not Gummy. But perhaps I'm just not seeing it as you two do." So this is something we didn't get into in our review. We both kind of agreed tacitly that we felt we knew.
Yeah,
we
had it was a strength of the movie for me.
Yeah.
It hinted that, just enough.
Yes. But I kept meaning to ask you later on, what exactly do you think that root was?
Well,
go for it.
Yeah, he does say it, but I want to acknowledge that I think there have to be a lot of factors at play for any type of feud in any family that might play out over 40 years or even 20 years or 5 years. It's not going to be necessarily just one defining incident. I think his abrasive personality is probably part of it. I mean, we see that he certainly seems to go downhill precipitously when the sheep all die, but that still suggested to me that he was in kind of bad shape before that and was a loner character that just wasn't a ray of sunshine. But it's not as if Gummy is a ray of sunshine either. He's a pretty abrasive personality too. So there clearly, or I think it's pretty clear anyway, there was probably some kind of tension always between them. But the big thing here, what was more than enough for me, and again, I love the fact that the movie just gave us this one thing and didn't feel compelled to explore it further, is that line where we hear that he owns all the land. It's not said explicitly, I don't think, but it's certainly suggested, and I think it's pretty clear, that Gummy is the landlord, and his brother, Kitty, is living on his land. He allows him to live there, even though Kitty is the older brother.
Right, okay. Right.
So imagine a family scenario, especially here in a country, in a territory, where this still applies to America as well, for the most part. But imagine this place where the land and your property is everything. This farm and the animals that live on it are everything to them. And he was such a screw up. We don't know why or what he did, but Kitty was such a screw up that even though he was the oldest son, his father said, "There's no way I'm leaving all of this to you. I'm choosing your brother over you." Yes, that would make him not only angry at his father, but I believe that would make him angry at his brother too. And that would sow the seeds of all that discontent for 40 years. I know what happens. I can tell you examples in real life that I'm aware of, even including in my own family, going back like great-grandparents fighting over the Iowa farm, the little bit of farmland they have, brothers who have a falling out over who inherits the land. And the two sides of the family don't speak to each other. So yeah, that was more than enough for me.
Yeah, it doesn't often take much to have a decades-long family feud. And that all makes sense to me, made sense within the context of the film. And maybe I'm way off on what I was also wondering in addition to that. And it has to do with one of those breakdown scenes. It's the one where Kitty attacks Gummy from behind in the barn, forces him down into the ground, and is really on top of him, shoving his face into the dirt. And you wonder if he's going to kill him at this point. He says something there, and this is conjecture. I'd be curious if any other listener who watched Rams along with us picked up on maybe this being somewhere in the background. I wish I could remember the phrase because I actually wrote it down, but I don't have my notes with me. Something about, "We're finally together how you wanted," or something. And maybe it's because I also had that documentary I mentioned, Brother's Keeper, in my head, where one of the brothers, these hermit brothers in upstate New York, one of them dies and there's an investigation to see what happened. And along the investigation, there's the consideration of a sexual relationship possibly being between the two brothers. That's in Brother's Keeper. This could have just been playing with my mind here, but I do wonder if not that there was that sort of relationship, but some sort of incident
right.
that might have happened way yeah. back when that Gummy is never going to forgive him for, or even maybe the hint of it. I don't know. But it just – there was something so
yeah.
physical
yeah, and primal about it.
Mm-hmm. about that moment between them. Even if it's not something specifically like that, feeling the anger there mm-hmm. made me not need to know the details, which, as we've said, is a strength of the
film. Yeah, the strength is there's real ambiguity there, but not – vagueness. There's a lot of specificity
exactly.
to their relationship that then allows us to speculate and consider what some of the causes of this feud just might be. I'm with you. Here we are again agreeing with each other. I did go with Sigur Jonsson as Gummy for my favorite lead performance. That face, he's got a face that is as mysterious as the disease that's killing their sheep, and it's as haunted as that relationship between him and his brother. And you're right, it's not a big performance by any means, but big compared to the only other ones I really considered from this marathon, Andre Wilms as Marcel in La Havre and Marku Peltola as M in The Man Without a Past. Those are subtle, deadpan, non-emotive performances, and maybe that's why I gave Sigur Jonsson a slight advantage, because there's those elements to his performance mm-hmm. in Rams, but we get to see some other sides to him as well. So that's probably a good transition into our favorite deadpan moment. We always try to pick one category that seems right in line with this marathon, and that word came up over and over again as it's continuing to come up here. So what's yours?
For me, this had to come from one of the two Roy Anderson films that we watched, and I am going to pick one of the vignettes from You the Living. It's the tablecloth trick where the man at a dinner party tries to yank the tablecloth out from underneath this. It's got to be 12 feet long. It's a 12-person mm-hmm. table at least that's filled with priceless china. Now, this whole sequence is set up by this guy who pulls the trick. He tells us that he experienced this as a dream, okay? So we know what's coming. He tells us the whole thing before we then cut to a reenactment of it. And the trick itself, after we've already been told, is 2 minutes long. And this is a crucial element of deadpan, right? Mm-hmm. Drawing it out as long as possible without cracking a smile. And I can't think of a better example than this. I mean, this guy takes his time when we get to the trick, walking around the table. He gently tugs the tablecloth and kind of teases us. Then he goes and straightens one of the dishes. And everyone else who's at this dinner party is standing around the wall, just watching him.
Yeah.
No expression
yeah.
on their faces.
So good.
Finally, he pulls the cloth. Disastrously. I mean, he destroys yeah. every single thing in this loud clatter. He even falls over backwards. And here's the deadpan kicker, right? Everyone around him, no reaction.
Yeah, nothing.
Whatsoever. They just stand there silent while he stumbles back to his feet and just holds a few broken shards in his
yeah,
hands.
Yeah, it's so good. I really strongly considered that, but I'm glad I didn't go with it. One of my honorable mentions, the tablecloth trick gone wrong, my favorite moment in You the Living, the haircut gone wrong, uh-huh. also a great deadpan moment in that film. So I considered those two. And then I went with more Anderson in terms of strong consideration to the two scenes that I've mentioned a few times. Callie going to the institution to visit his son Thomas with the doctor observing them. And then Jesus on the cross, the sales convention, where two men are having a conversation in the foreground and just behind him, Jesus on the cross slips and just keeps swinging
by
one nail in the
yeah.
background. The swinging crucifix is so good. And there's another moment that I don't know if we spent much time on it, but in Songs from the Second Floor, where an old soldier is getting tribute paid to him, but he's now like in a home and he's clearly not all there anymore. And he does a Heil Hitler salute and then just throws out the line, "Give my best to Goering." Like, those are the wonderful moments we get in these Anderson films. One moment I also thought about from The Man Without a Past is when we meet the landlord and he just deadpan mentions his savage dog.
Oh, yeah, the dog.
And we cut to the dog, who, of course, looks completely harmless, right? Would never hurt anybody. So I did like that moment. But for me, it's more Rams love here. It is that moment, the emergency room drop-off, where the brothers we were just talking about, despite their hatred for each other, when Gummy comes across his brother Kitty, drunk, we think, possibly dying in a snow ditch. He's been out there for who knows how many hours. He hops in his tractor, picks him up, and then drives the many miles into town so that he can lower the tractor and drop him off at the emergency room entrance.
It's a dump. It's more than a lower. It's a dump.
It really is. You're right. It's so simultaneously uncaring and loving. It feels so cold and brutal that it's a tractor, but at the same time, it is quite a journey. It takes real effort. In this region where they're living, you can't just call an ambulance and wait for it to show up. It takes a long time for him to make the journey across bridges and everything else, all to save his brother, all ultimately because he does care enough to save his brother. I also think that that moment really employs the harshness and the majesty of the Scandinavian landscape. Mm-hmm. So that felt like another good reason to mention Rams there. And that brings us to one more email on Rams. We got this. I love this from Gabe Diani. I just watched Rams with my girlfriend. And she hasn't been this furious with me since we watched Boy and They Killed a Goat.
Uh-oh.
Now, based on your review that included the words whimsy and deadpan humor, I've made her watch a movie with an entire sheep genocide.
This is true.
Do you know how hard it is to get a Netflix pick in that's not British people solving murders in sleepy little English hamlets? Murdered Britons are fine, apparently. Would it kill you to give a little spoiler-free warning of, hey, there's some light to heavy sheep death in this one, folks? I will literally never live this movie pick down. Ever. That said, yes, it was deadpanningly humorous when Gummy picked up Kitty and dropped him at the hospital with his tractor.
Many sheep were harmed in this movie.
Many sheep. Well, we hope not in real life, but it certainly looks like they were, and maybe we can make it up to Gabe by mentioning that his second feature film, Diani and Divine Meet the Apocalypse, is playing this October, Josh, at the Austin Film Festival. He says, no animals die, just good old-fashioned ancillary human characters.
Well, that's as it should be.
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes we really do fail when we're talking about these films, where we always worry that we're getting too specific and we don't want to get into spoilers too heavy. And then at the same time, that can cause us to be so vague that maybe we don't really get into some of the most basic details. Now, I do believe, I'm going to say, Gabe, I could be wrong, I haven't re-listened to it, but I do believe at some point we did note the fact that the reason these brothers are spiraling down is because they lose all their sheep. There's a bunch of sheep death in this movie. I thought we said that.
I'm going to guess we referenced the disease.
Yes.
But I don't know. And it does. It gets pretty brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, he's right.
We probably didn't sell that enough.
But would that have been a spoiler?
No. I don't know.
Our apologies.
Yeah, indeed. We do apologize to Gabe and to his girlfriend. Okay. So we'll see if there's any more Rams talk as we get into our final two picks, our final sad tubas. Favorite scene or moment, not deadpan scene, but just overall scene or moment.
I didn't grab a scene or moment.
No?
I thought it was just deadpan we were doing. We're going to do another moment?
Well, we've always done this with Elaine May. We did like the best couple, but we also did, we did the funniest moment, but also just the best moment, I think.
Give me your moment.
Okay. My moment is from Songs from the Second Floor. It might have been the tractor drop if that wasn't such a great deadpan moment, but overall, I think the moment for me that's going to define this marathon, certainly visually, the moment I'm always going to remember is the closing scene to Songs from the Second Floor. And I considered other moments from Songs here. We talked about the Nighthawks diner shot with the traffic jam. One of my favorites, the playtime influenced, I have to imagine, scene where the airport travelers show up approaching the counters, and there's just this brutal comic absurdity of them all trying to get to the counter to get to their destination, but they can't even get to the counter. They're moving so slow. I love that. But for me, ultimately, it was about the closing scene. And I don't know that you can really spoil a movie like Songs from the Second Floor, but the crosses come back into play at the end. They're thrown into a pile at the dump. A few past characters reemerge, and then some others are walking down a path toward the camera. And then almost like an optical illusion, masses of people appear walking toward us. And it's such a kind of take your breath away moment. And it's sad and hopeless, but somehow hopeful and beautiful at the same time. For me, it's a summation of everything that makes Songs from the Second Floor such a good movie. That still frame, the long take, but those surprises as a scene plays out. There's always something to look at, some new bit of information introduced into that frame that makes it really fascinating to watch.
That's a good pick, and I would probably go with it. It's going to come up yet, spoiler.
Okay.
When I make my final award.
Well, let's do it.
But I do have another one I'll throw out there because you didn't, as far as a favorite moment. And it's the train apartment in You the Living, where it's another dream, right? It's the woman's
dream.
That
was Alison Wilmore's big scene.
Yes. And they are newlyweds. They've come back to their first apartment. And we start to notice out the window that things seem to be moving oddly. And we can't quite figure it out until eventually we realize that they're actually on a train. Their apartment is somehow on a train. It ends up at a station with people standing there looking at them through the window. They're looking at the crowd. And it's just this lovely, yeah, romantic vignette that's a little – I talked about this with You the Living, out of step with the maybe humorous pessimism that Songs from the Second Floor has.
There is romance and magic in that moment, but is there enough to make You the Living your favorite film of this marathon? I don't think it probably was.
I went with the other Anderson. I went with Songs from the Second Floor. I really do think it's this malaise-inflected masterpiece. I did name it just last show as one of my top five comedies of the 21st century. So if you haven't listened to that yet, I do share some of my reasoning there. But, you know, besides it being this constant source of a low boil laughter, mm-hmm, that I loved, there's also something very true and very unnerving about the existential unease that this movie taps into. And even in funny scenes like the one you mentioned at the airport with the people going towards the counter or the traffic jams, mm-hmm, that we continually see. But it's mostly that finale that, yeah, you picked with those figures arising from the field and approaching the camera in long shot. It's just, it's one that I can't shake. And because there are so many layers going on to it, I can't quite wrap my head around it yet. Not every marathon we've done delivers a major discovery for me. I know that's always our hope. Happens quite frequently. It happened this time with Songs from the Second Floor. I got,
yeah,
one.
I'm with you. It's absolutely my pick. This was an easy one for me. My sad tuba for Best Picture goes to that Roy Anderson film because of everything you said, because of all the scenes I've enumerated here going through my picks, the ones I did ultimately go with, the ones I strongly considered. Overall, just the pure visual poetry of it. And don't listen to what Josh is saying about Low Boil. I mean, he put it on his top five 21st century comedies. It's basically Step Brothers in Swedish. I mean, just go into it expecting Step Brothers in Swedish and you will be rewarded.
That would be a mistake.
Okay. But I think there are a lot of genuine laughs there. A couple times, the scenes I mentioned, the cross, the institution, made me laugh out loud. Mm-hmm. And overall, that visual wonder is something that really set it apart from all the other films. And I say wonder in that it's not bravura filmmaking. It's a lot of still frames, but that's enough when you're packing the frame with that much
but
detail.
But very intricately composed,
exactly,
and depth of field
and choreographed.
So much, yes,
ultimately,
yes, so much,
yeah,
going on.
So I'll also throw out there with all those other reasons that it does depict, and we touched on this a little bit during our review of it, it depicts not just a spiritual purgatory, but an economic one that feels very prescient as you're watching a film from 2000, 2001, as we were going into this new millennium and somehow was foreseeing, in a way, 2008, 2009, 2010, and the economic malaise that the whole world would really endure. So there's a lot going on in this film, within the frames of this film. And if there was one movie you had to see from this marathon, it's Songs for the Second Floor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. With that, we say farvel. I don't know what that means, but we're going to say farvel.
Is that Danish? Swedish?
I'm not going to offend any more listeners.
Oh, okay.
To our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon, if you've played along at all, maybe just a few of the movies, maybe all of them, we'd still love to hear your sad tubas. Share your favorite moments and performances from the marathon. Email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. This gives us an opportunity to mention our next marathon. We've already plugged it once, but Luis Buñuel is up next. So not a region, but one auteur. And you can get a head start with a couple of Buñuel's early shorts. We're going to start it off with 1929's Un Chien Andalou and L'Âge d'Or from 1930.
And don't wait, because we're getting into this one right away in,
yeah,
a few shows,
yeah,
from now.
6:05 is the episode we're planning to start the marathon. We've already gotten a lot of good responses to what I said a few shows ago, mentioning that maybe we could have gone with a few different movies. It's always a crapshoot, as we noted, but we think we've got a pretty formidable lineup here of six Buñuel films. You can find that lineup and how to see those movies at filmspotting.net. Just click on the marathons tab, and we're happy that this marathon is going to be presented by our friends at Mubi.
Two of the films in the marathon, that's the best way to see them, actually, is to start a Mubi account. Robinson Crusoe and Death in the Garden are both going to be available on the platform. So thanks very much to Mubi for sponsoring this marathon. We wanted to mention a few of the films you can see on Mubi right now in case you want to jump right in. One of those is Los Sures. What is now the luxury hipster brand name Williamsburg was not long ago a poor Latino neighborhood in seemingly out-of-the-way Brooklyn. Mubi says that this is an essential document of an era and area gentrification has nearly erased. Los Sures has been newly restored by the New York Public Library and Union Docks. Another option at Mubi right now is The Distance. In Spanish director Sergio Caballero's Tiger Award-winning debut, Finisterre, two Russian ghosts journey back to life. This is his equally audacious follow-up, and it features an imprisoned performance artist, a trio of telepathic dwarves, and even more surrealist play. Sounds like maybe a good companion piece to the Buñuel Marathon.
Indeed. I was going to say it sounds like Stefan from Saturday Night Live has introduced a new club in New York City that we should all hit. It's got imprisoned and performance artists, a trio of telepathic dwarves, and surrealist play.
Very nice.
Can't wait to go.
Everyday Movies curators introduce a new title and you have 30 days to watch it. That means there's always 30 wonderful films to enjoy. And you get this for only $4.99 a month. Plus, when you use Mubi's mobile app, you can download films to watch offline. Film spotting listeners, you can try Mubi free for a month. Just go to Mubi.com/filmspotting. That's Mubi.com/filmspotting.
That's our show, folks. We're going to get back to prepping for our Oliver Stone extravaganza. If you have any comments about this episode, email us feedback@filmspotting.net, or you can leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You can find that number on the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm at Filmspotting. Josh is at Larson on Film.
Also at filmspotting.net, you can find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. While you're there, go ahead and vote in the current Filmspotting polls. Yes, that's polls. Best Denzel Washington performance and favorite Denzel Washington performance. You can turn yourself inside out trying to decide which is which. If you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Those would be The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. Find them both in iTunes or through your favorite podcast app.
Out in limited release this weekend, opening in Chicago, Kicks and London Road, a movie that came up during our fall movie preview I'm very curious about. In wide release, Bridget Jones's Baby, the new Blair Witch.
Excited about that one.
Yep. And Snowden, the latest from Oliver Stone, who, as we've said here, we're going to build our next show around. Matt Zoller Seitz is going to come on. He's going to share his top five Oliver Stone moments. And we're going to do a Sacred Cow review of Born on the 4th of July.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week came from Frankie Lee. It's from the album American Dreamer. More information is at frankieleemusic.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Are we doing some hot mics
we
this
can.
Time? Because I have more aquatic misadventures with the family to share.
Can't
I don't
wait.
Think I've told you this.
Any kayaks involved?
Well, a raft. We went river rafting. We upped it a little bit. And little did I know that in, I don't even know if it's Western Illinois, it's probably Central, but Ottawa, you know, Starved Rock, that area. We usually go around this time of year for a weekend.
We went there a few years ago.
Yeah. So we went over Labor Day. And since it's been a bit of a tradition, we're looking for new things to do and found there's river rafting nearby, not on the Illinois River, which is big, but there's the Vermilion River about 20 minutes away, a little further west and south. And I thought, this will be great. I've done it in West Virginia. I've done it in Colorado. Love it. And brought it up to the family. I'm not going to name names, but one of the children was not so excited about the idea.
Okay.
But I thought, again, it's Illinois. How wild can it be? I even called ahead the night before and was like, what's this like? I swear the guy said, you've got the guide. He'll handle everything. It's like class one. And I'm like, yeah, this all makes sense. We're just going to be floating down the river. So we get there, again, dragging someone along a little bit, start getting our equipment, our helmets, our paddles, and I'm looking around waiting to be introduced to the guide. And this is like
and
in the middle
you.
Of nowhere. This was like somebody's backyard, essentially. I mean, it was a legit business, but they essentially had their home on the river, so they turned it into a rafting business. And finally I said, so where's the guide? And he says, you're the guide. And she looks at me like death rays.
So this is,
right?
This, let's just say it. It's your wife, right?
No. One of the kids.
Oh,
one of the
okay.
kids.
It is one of the kids.
I would rat Debbie out if she, no,
yes.
she's crazy. She was all for it. So three of the four members of the family were really excited. So we say, well, we're just going to go do it. It'll be no problem. It's a slow river, right? So we get the instructions, get on the river. It's fine. There are two, I don't even know if you could call them rapids, but there's one area where there are a bunch of boulders that have created a maybe 3 to 4 foot drop. There's a boulder at the bottom. You have to kind of paddle around. So it's, you know, significant. And we're coming up on this and I'm thinking, no problem. You know, I've been on much faster rivers. We had been doing fine as a team. Say, let's just watch the boat ahead of us, see what they do, and we'll follow them and we'll know, right?
Yeah.
Two people, they go over, smash into the boulder, and it's like their raft explodes. They go flying everywhere.
No.
Yes, completely out. Unexcited child looks at me and is like, you have killed us,
uh-huh.
right? So we say, let's pull over to the side and regroup here. Even worse, there's an older couple in a raft to the left. They've chosen to carry their raft over the rocks because they're so freaked out about this. Meanwhile, I have the other child saying, let's go. We can do it. So we say, let's watch one more raft and see what they do. The next raft comes by, three people. They go over. They paddle, as you're told, around the boulder. Make it fine.
Yeah.
So we could do this, right? So we jump in and we go for it. What do you think? Do we pull it off or not?
Well, you're here to tell the story.
We're here, so that's a hint.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and if someone was really injured, I probably wouldn't be telling the story either. I was proud of our performance.
We survived.
We paddled, went to the left, caught the boulder on the tail end of the raft, so it spun us a little bit, but we were okay.
And wow.
It was really fun.
Was it? How long were you out there?
Well, it was 3.5 hours. Because we were kind of slow, too, in the paddling. And there were long stretches where you're just sitting there. It was really very calm.
Okay.
But we did get drenched. I mean, like,
yeah.
The whole raft was full of water. We had to get to the side and dump it out at the bottom of these rapids. So, it was fun.
Well, my fun this weekend was of a much more traditional variety, I guess, and much less dangerous and harrowing, it sounds like. But I was checking movie times, like on Friday at the theater we both frequent out in our suburb. And I noticed that because of Gene Wilder, and we've seen some of these.
Yeah, they've been adding.
Tweeted, and they're sharing that, you know, some of these multiplexes are showing Blazing Saddles and some of these films, that our theater at 5 o'clock on Sunday was showing Willy Wonka.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I had seen it a few years ago because I thought I sat the kids down. This could have been 5 years ago. I have no concept, but I know I watched it with Holden and Sophie. Quinn, maybe. He might have paid attention. I definitely didn't even bother with Connor. I think he was pretty young. Again, he's only 6 right now. So I thought this is going to be pretty great to see this movie on the big screen.
Yeah,
and
with an audience,
the kids
hopefully.
And with an audience. And, you know, it didn't disappoint. And there was a part of me, even knowing I had seen it fairly recently, where I was worried about whether or not it was going to hold up.
Mm.
Is this something that I truly do only revere because of the nostalgia factor, and that probably is a factor. But at the same time, I still found myself getting swept up in it.
Yeah.
I still thought it was hilarious. I still thought that Gene Wilder was amazing to watch, obviously incredibly charismatic. And I appreciate even more his little asides and his gestures and his facial reactions to things. And the kids actually really liked it too. I mean, Connor, same thing with every movie. It's too long.
Sure.
He can't handle it.
Was he scared at all?
No, he wasn't. But that scene didn't make any sense to me when I was 6
yeah.
when they go down the water. And I thought that was much later in the movie, that tunnel and those crazy images.
The psychedelic colors.
Centipedes and stuff crawling across people's faces. And I'm watching it today thinking, why is that here? Like, I still don't totally understand why that scene is there other than he was clearly trying to scare the hell out of him. But it worked. All three kids liked it. Of course, the older kids, they see the movie. They are familiar with Wonka more so because of memes, right?
Oh,
all the
absolutely.
Wonka memes
yeah.
out there. So then actually getting to see those come to life and see where they come from, they thought it was great.
That's
so
fun.
Yeah, it was good.
I remember being terrified of not only of the tunnel sequence, but just of Wilder in general, you know, because as we touched on, he was a loose cannon and you didn't quite trust him. You were fascinated, mesmerized by him, but you didn't want to get too close.
Now, the one thing I took away on this viewing that I had never considered before is that all the kids who are terrible kids, except Charlie, and they all get their comeuppance.
Yeah.
Right? All of them deserve it, certainly. And all of them deserve it partly because he warns them. He tells them what the rules are very clearly and emphatically. Right. And then they set about to break those rules. So they're bad kids. They're bad eggs, right? But poor Augustus. I have sympathy now for poor Augustus Gloop, maybe because I, too, want to just dive into the chocolate river. I can really
That's
relate to that.
That's just unfair. That's just too tempting.
He says when they go in, he says, everything
That's
here
true.
Is edible. Everything is edible.
That's
At
true.
No point does he say, oh, and by the way, no hands, nobody can touch the chocolate river.
There was no sign, no swimming, no wading, no ice skating.
I didn't see it. He gives them no warning, except for when he's already started drinking out of it. He then comes over and says, oh, no, you mustn't. Augustus, you mustn't.
Yeah.
And he falls in. So he tells him to stop, and he doesn't stop. I'll give him that. But unlike all the other kids who get fair warning, he's already started. No one told him.
Here's the thing about Willy Wonka, too, that made me worried. I could see him giving him a little shove, you know, a little shove into the river.
He was trying to weed out all these children.
Totally.
He absolutely was. That also
becomes
really clear.
This is why you can't trust him.
Yeah, you can't.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.